Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us here. We're about to have a conversation that I've been looking for a long time, and it's during our fun drive here, so I'm going to have to ask our guests to come back on another day so we don't have a pledge break, because this is an amazing book, an amazing story, and one that needs to be in the annals of who we are as human beings and how this capitalism in Western Hemisphere actually began and what this all meant. We're about to talk to Andrea Stewart. Andrea Stewart's book is Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. She was born and raised in Barbados and the United States and Great Britain. She studied in Britain and in France. Her other books, which are really good, I remember the one I read first was The Rose of Martinique, A Life of Napoleonist Josephine. And she's with us here now. Andrea Stewart, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Delighted to be with you.
You're talking to us from where? The Barbados right now?
From London.
From London. Oh, London, one of my favorite cities on the planet. So let's go back to give our listeners kind of a broad breadth of understanding of what we're talking about in this book. That you are from a Barbadian family, and this book you've written was your own sojourn to trace your family back, even though you didn't know what you quite were going to find. But what you found were this world of slaveholders and slaves in the birthplace almost of slavery in the Western Hemisphere, Barbados, your homeland. Tell us about why you went on this journey and what that meant.
Well, I think like a lot of people, I was fascinated by my family past, and I had a very, very charismatic uncle who used to tell me brilliant stories about my background. And so I was always predisposed, I think, to find out about my history, I think as many of us are. And then when I started on the journey, I realized that I was very lucky in that I had an unbroken history back 8 generations, which is kind of unusual. So I could really trace my family in Barbados right back to the early days of Atlantic settlement in the mid-17th century. And my first ancestor was a very a young blacksmith who basically left England, as so many other people did, to settle in the Americas, and he chose Barbados.
And he chose Barbados. Now, the way you describe Barbados in the beginning as this island inundated with Europeans, with white people, indentured servants, even before the first slaves arrived. Go ahead. I'm sorry. That was really interesting to me.
Yes. Well, I think people assume always, because now when you think of the Caribbean, you think of Afro-Caribbeans. But really, of course, Barbados was one of the few islands that was empty. It had no local people on it. And so the English who settled there relied on white indentured servants as their main labor force. They were a smattering of black people, but they were not by any means the dominant major, you know, working force. And so what happened was that really it was a European world for the early part of settlement. And it was only when the whole sugar crop became valuable and important that they began to think seriously about trying to get more workers, and in this case they went for slaves because it was economically more viable than trying to find more white people to come over, many of whom by now had heard the stories about how terrible the white indentured servants were treated, and they really didn't have enough people willing to come over to take over the workforce.
And there were two things were born. One, slavery was born. Just to make sure the crops came in and sugar built the world we have today, which is something is what you will point out in your book as well.
Exactly. One of the things that we forget, of course, is that, I mean, now sugar is so ubiquitous we can't really imagine a world without it. But in the very early days, you know, before George Ashby, my ancestor, arrived in Barbados, it was still a minority crop and something that was enjoyed mainly by the rich and the privileged. And what happened was that they realized once sugar started as and became a viable crop on the island, the desire for it, the need for it, or the sort of consumption of it, grew and grew and grew until it became part of everybody's life, everybody's day-to-day life, no matter how poor you were or how rich you were, sugar was part of your world. And so it was perhaps to the 18th century what we would say oil would have been to the last century. It was, somebody described it as the commodity that turned the world. It was that valuable and that important.
We're talking right now with Andrea Stewart about her amazing book, Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. It is a book about the hideousness and complexity of slavery, how it defined a world and defines this world as well as it defined her family and defines families throughout this hemisphere and families in Europe. And we are going to come back to this conversation with Andrea Stewart in just a moment. We've got to take a quick run over to Pledge Central to offer you this book and offer you a chance to support your public radio station at 410-319-8888. So stay with us. Don't go away. We'll go into Pledge Central and come right back to continue our conversation with Andrea Stewart about Sugar in the Blood. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are here with Andrea Stewart talking about her latest work, Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire, where she found the roots to her family. And Andrea, allow me to jump into a few really important pieces here from the beginning of your book, because one of the things that really struck me is that, as I said when we were going to break here, was this is in many ways about the hideousness and complexity of slavery, which
Absolutely.
You unfolded.
Yes, I think one of the extraordinary complexities of my story is the realization that, of course, like many people, and I think not many people realize this, I'm a descendant both of slaves and slave owners, and I can pinpoint the particular point where my planter descendant decides. Or is privileged enough to and powerful enough to have, alongside a legitimate white wife and child, 18 children with slave women, of which I'm descended from one of them. And so you had, on the same plantation, we had my forefather having. Living with a whole raft of children that he had with slave women, and with his wife living on the same plantation. And I think that's one of the realities of slave life that is so hard to understand. It's like being in a state of war, but the most intimate kind of war, because everybody lives together in the same space. And I think that that's one of the things about the plantation world that we sometimes, I think, slightly underestimate.
So this was the slave owner, the just John Cooper Ashby and Mary Ann Ashby, which led to the your family, to you today.
Absolutely, and in that historical moment, they created they shaped my whole life, which is extraordinary, really. The idea that we could be, part of this extraordinary story, and have to deal with or reconcile, which I think has been one of the great challenges for me, that, my ancestor was willing to own my other ancestor and didn't find that in any way problematic or difficult.
And to own your own child, to be your child as your property that should be bought and sold and to do with whatever you like.
Exactly. And I think that is something that is almost impossible for us to get our heads around.
In terms of the hideousness and the violence, I want you to talk a bit about the violence in a moment. I'd like to read a quick passage from your book. And when we go back to our pleasure break, if there's a passage you'd like to think about coming back from that, that you'd love to read, we'd love to hear it. But it just struck me when you talked about the violence of slavery. This was One slave, you said, recollecting their sufferings, declared, "Had they not hung men with heads downward, drowned them in sacks, crucified them on planks, buried them alive, crushed in mortars? Had they not forced them to eat excrement? Had they not thrown them into boiling cauldrons of cane syrup? Have they not put men and women inside barrels studded with spikes and rolled them down mountainsides into the abyss?" This is the violence of the slaveholder to the slave.
Yes, I mean, I think even I, who thought that I was fairly well-versed in slave history, just didn't appreciate just how extraordinarily violent this system was. On an average plantation, it was said that there were at least 60 punishments a day, you know, kind of ranging from casual beatings right down to amputations and even murders. So the whole sort of, I just didn't quite grasp, I think, how terrible the daily life of a plantation was.
So I'm curious, and I don't mean to jump from the beginning of the book to the back of the book, to the end of the book, but one of the things, the violence and horrendousness of plantation life in slavery, even though the violence and some of the horrendous aspects of slavery didn't survive into the 20th century, the fact that your family ended up later actually owning the plantation in Barbados as well, and you talk really interestingly and eloquently about the mentality of the plantation, no matter what century it's in, and who owns the plantation.
Absolutely. I think what you had was a kind of unique social unit where people, certain traditions were developed, which actually carried on, you know, long after slavery was abolished, into the present day. And so my grandfather, for example, owned a plantation. It was smaller than my previous, you know, mentioned forefather, but he also had many of the attitudes that the planters traditionally had. He had a number of extramarital affairs with women who worked his land. He tended to see, there's a famous occasion that when he got drunk and shot at various of his workers because he was in a bad mood. It was this sort of rather quixotic, strange, violent, very ambivalent attitude to his workers that would have existed when slavery still was going on. And so I think it's a unit that's quite, I think that's one of the reasons why so many writers write about the plantation situation, and so many movies, as we know, are coming out now about it, because it's such a uniquely intense, ambivalent, extraordinary social space.
And that still defines us at this moment. I think that's the piece of this, and the complexities and your own struggles around it. I mean, I think that going back in a bit in this history, I mean, despite being mixed race, despite the growth of the kind of Creole population in Barbados, people were still slaves. Your ancestors were still slaves.
Yes, absolutely, and you know, there may have been advantages from being the descendant of a planter, but in reality, that is the dominant identity of everybody in my historical line. And it's extraordinary because I remember when I first discovered my first black ancestor, Robert Cooper's son, illegitimate son, John Stephen, and I had never felt such exhilaration. I was in a library and I kind of punched my fist in the air and made a big whooping sound because I felt like I had done something amazing. I had actually saved him from history. Because the truth is that one of the great crimes of history is the way that slaves were written out of the story. That they were never, you know, they moved as chattel. They had no names. When they moved across the Atlantic, everything was broken down so that the only way you could know them was in their relationship to a white person or the plantation owners or whatever. And so you had this. It was to discover him and re-enshrine him in history felt like such a great victory. I felt so amazingly pleased.
We're having a very important conversation here with Andrea Stewart about her book, Sugar in the Blood, a family story of slavery and empire. And we are going to take a brief break. And when we come back from Pledge Central, we're going to explore more in depth her family, the emancipation of slaves, what that meant, the difficulty in what happened in modern Barbados, looking at the sexualization of slaveries and of slaves, and how they had to be baptized first before they were even at 14, before they went to the master. We'll talk about all that and more, and how that affected her life and family, as we talk with Andrea Stewart about an amazing new book, Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're here with Andrea Stewart talking about her book, Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. And Andrea Stewart, there's so much packed into this book, and we have such little time today. I apologize for that. But I think that talk about what you – I'm very curious about, as you kind of wound your way through unveiling the stories of your family, of the history of your the people you were descended from the people who created kind of the Creole society inside of Barbados, and also what you and the kind of complexity of how slavery and sugar created this modern capitalism and all the great institutions of Britain and Europe, like where you are sitting now. And what what discovery that was for you? What kind of discoveries you made for yourself along the way in kind of with that world opening up to you?
Well, I think like a lot of people who are black and live in Britain, there's always been this sort of idea that that's been discussed, that we're sort of a kind of newcomers to the British Isles, and we don't, and there isn't kind of a real recognition of this long history that we have. And so, for me, one of the things that this process did was kind of validate my position of living in London, England generally, but also I think it made me understand just how extraordinarily the slave communities across the Atlantic world, in the U.S. and South America and the Caribbean, how much they created the wealth of Europe and mainstream America. We, you know, there's that sort of sense of, kind of us being this sort of troublesome kind of social group. Well, in fact, without Britain, for example, was built on the legacy of sugar. It was one of the great economic pillars of the country, and yet it's forgotten and undiscussed. And sugar did the same in Brazil and in states in the U.S. like Louisiana and so on. Later on, contemporarily Florida. So you have this understanding of the enormous contribution the slave population who were involved and lived and died to make this commodity circulate through the world. How incredibly important our contribution has been to the contemporary world and the contemporary financial world in particular.
One of the things I'd like to talk about for a few minutes here is Robert Cooper, your great, great, great grandfather who created this plantation, and his marriage to Mary Burke in 1794, and what that meant. This is the beginning of the sojourn.
Well, I think he is the point where our family becomes rich. I think the dream of sugar was always that you'd get rich overnight, but it took on my family 4 generations. And he married a woman who had a rich dowry and called Mary Burke, and he built on what she contributed to him and created a large and successful plantation. And he's, I say, the beginning of, in some ways, the very immediate beginning of our story, because it is him who has these 18 slave children from which I am descended. And I think he was very much emblematic of the complexities of the age, because he had long and, who knows, sometimes we can imagine one of his mistresses he was had 11 children with, and when his wife died, he openly acknowledged her, So some of these women he perhaps had real feelings for. But it's impossible to say in the kind of, I think, the exploitative violence of a plantation to know whether these relationships were loving or not, because, or could be anything like that, because if you can't say no, you can't really say yes. And that was true for all the women on his plantation. They couldn't say no to him, and therefore, you know, that was the reality of being a planter. But he was also, as well as his own plantation, he was also a militia man, a colonel in the militia, and he was also a magistrate, so he was involved in all the processes that kept the slave community in order.
And one of the things you talk about here, I think that is so kind of chilling in some ways, is the rules that kind of facilitated but also were made to, as you put it, to facilitate white men's sexual exploitation of black women. That to me was a fascinating piece in the Plantocrat chapter of your book.
Well, it is extraordinary, because one of the things that the Barbadians, when they first set up slave society, and you have to remember that the Barbadians were the model that a lot of the American states, Virginia and other places, also used to set up their own slave laws. So its influence on America was very direct. And one of the things that they did was completely go against all their historical traditions and made it that slavery would pass that through the female line. So this meant that they were allowed to, you know, if hereditary went through the male line, which it does in every other circumstances, particularly in the old countries, this way they got the chance of being able to exploit their slaves without compromising their ability to own their slaves. So rather remarkably, it meant that they could have as much free reign with their slaves, but the offspring would still be slaves and therefore would not threaten the basic power structure that they wanted to maintain. So it's an extraordinary aberration and very much designed to preserve this sexual privilege.
And the kind of such really horrendous twist for me is reading the book that in order for the slave master to have sex with the women, the black women that they owned as slaves, the women had to be baptized first as children so they wouldn't be having sex with the heathen.
Yes, it's kind of extraordinary to me that you could contemplate having what often was rape.
Was rape,
rape, and the person concerned was basically often a child, you know, 13 or 14, but that they would often, in the case of my ancestor, for example, decide that he would baptize him first because while he could have forced sex and he could have sex with a child, he couldn't have sex with a heathen. And that seems to me such a contradiction in any kind of moral universe that it's bare beggar's belief, really.
We're talking with Andrea Stewart, this amazing book that just... it's so eye-opening, and we're going to kind of explore when we come back from this break to go back to Pledge Central more about her family now and the complexities of all that, and her father and the way he grew up and where this meant and the labor movement in Barbados and more, and how it all is directly tied to this world of slavery and her mixed ancestry of slave and slaveholder. Very few people have been able to go back and really kind of parse out their families to understand both with so much depth. The book is Sugar in the Blood, Andrea Stewart, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. We're going to go over to Pledge Central. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are talking with Andrea Stewart about her marvelous book, Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. So one of the things I've thought about, and I think it's important to explore with this book, is how your ancestors the people you were descended from who were born out of slavery but born and continued in slavery, how that wealth affected and didn't affect his offspring and your ancestors?
Well, I think, one of the things I wanted to say before we get to that is...
Please, go ahead.
To stress, for American audiences, how incredibly influential this little island was on what would happen later on on the mainland U.S. Because when in Barbados, they were working out the laws that, and not just the laws, but the ideas around racism that would be used against black people across the world. And I found when I was doing research this letter about an Englishman writing back to somebody in England saying, describing himself as white, a white person. And he was saying, this is the term we use here for Europeans. And what you see is the invention of that kind of racism, that idea, because at that point, Europeans didn't think of themselves as being whites versus blacks. Blacks, the black slaves who came over from Africa were basically from different tribal groups and different, they thought of themselves as their own ethnic groups or Igbo or whatever they were. But they didn't think of themselves as black any more than at that point in the early days, the European population thought themselves as white. But what they needed and what they did do was develop a racist ideology that they used in order to justify the incredible violence and inhumanity of the slave system. And so what we have, and this idea, managed to travel across the whole of the Americas. And so it's really important what happens here in this little place, because these are, and even now in all our cities, I live in London, in Baltimore, and different American states and so on. The legacy of what they invented there is still oppressing people now and still affecting how we live and how we're treated and how people respond to us and what our life chances are and what we'll suffer from. And so it's incredibly significant. And that's just something that I wanted people to think about, that this is part of the mainland American story as much as it's part of the Caribbean story.
And I'm curious, again, before we go into what I asked earlier, because what you just said, and because it comes all through this book, is your own sense of, what's the word I'm looking for? One reviewer used the word complicity, but there's another word that's even better. I can't get in my mind right now, but that the idea that you're being descended from Robert Cooper Ashby, the slaveholder who gave birth, he didn't give birth, but father John Stephen Ashby, who became your mother's great great grandfather. I mean that to be able to discover that and understand what that means. I mean that's.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I thought afterwards, because people have always said to me, how do you deal with the fact that your ancestor owned his and was willing to and happily owned his own fresh flesh and blood, and didn't, and it's something that was one of the unique, terrible things about slavery, is that these kinds of relationships could happen. But I also think it says a lot about who. How these people thought and how monstrous they would become, because slavery demanded they behave in ways that were so unbearable and illogical and brutal in order to carry out that it's quite hard to even contemplate. And I think as well is that I read somewhere that 33% of the African American gene pool is white, which is similar to the Caribbean, and so a lot of people are the result of people who describe themselves as African American or African Caribbean are people who have the same story as mine, who have in their past a planter and slaves. And it does complexify things extraordinarily when you look back over your family tree and you see that these figures are both belong to you, or rather both produced you. And I think that's one of the things I wanted to do as well, is that complexifies lazy, because it is an enormously complicated ambivalent institution. And, you know, it's easy for us to think, oh, well, I'd really love to just be able to dismiss my white ancestor and describe him as, you know, an evil person. And, but he's also my ancestor. And like many people, I carry both those blood in my veins.
And, you know, so you come from a time when, as you write in your book, that Robert Cooper, the original slave owner, would learn to sleep through the sound of the bell that woke up the slaves, that forced them to the fields to work all day long, and many who died in the fields. Coming down to your mother and father, Barbara Cecile Ashby and Kenneth Lamont Stewart, on a plantation owned by your family, but your dad was also from a different place than your mother.
Yes, because my mother was the descendant of this long maternal line that we've been discussing, and my father was very much identified with and part of the black slave community. All of these people are black, but about how they identified in this historical moment. And my grandfather was not happy. My father was a very bright young man who went off to become a doctor. But my grandfather was very upset that my mother just chose him and referred to him as the black boy in the early part of her courtship, because he didn't feel he was good enough for my mother because he was dark-skinned, which, you know, seems to me so extraordinary in the 20th century, you know what I mean, 20 coming in, and then, you know, just that this idea could still be carried on. And so you had these horrible legacies of slavery, which are about rejecting who we really were and rejecting, our own racial identities because they've been so traduced by the slave system.
I'm going to thank Andrea Stewart for joining us here. Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. We look forward to having her back for much longer segments. This is just an amazing book, an amazing work, an amazing journey you've taken yourself and the rest of us on with you, Andrea Stewart. I want to thank you so much also for joining us today from London.
I've enjoyed it immensely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. We're going to jump over to Pledge Central and get you to join us here at 410-319-8888. This book can be in your library, on your coffee table, in your hands as you read it at night, and you're supporting your public radio station here, WEAA. Don't go away. We've got to go over to Pledge Central. So.